Chapter 6. Society. Theory in the Sciences. Not many years ago, the idea that, both in the USA and Europe, political movements involving varying degrees of fascism would gain considerable voter support in many Western countries, and come to power in some, would have seemed quite outlandish. Adorno, of course, would have found nothing outlandish about this, as his view of the persistence of what made fascism possible makes clear. So what is it about his theory of modern society that made him turn out to be prescient? A conference in 1961 at Tübingen University of the German Society for Sociology was the beginning of an influential debate on the methodology of the social sciences that involved Adorno, Karl Popper, Jürgen Habermas, Hans Albert, Ralph Dahrendorf, and other philosophers and social and political scientists, which came to be known as the positivism debate in German sociology. The label positivism in this context is actually more trouble than it is worth, because it has too many, sometimes conflicting, meanings. And Popper, for example, whom Adorno put in the category, objected to being included. Rather than get entangled in discussing the disputed definition of positivism, it is best to concentrate on the substance of the debate. This concerned the relationship between the natural sciences and the social sciences, and the status of their respective theoretical claims. Related debates had been part of the German academic landscape since the second half of the 19th century, centering around the idea that the natural sciences were concerned with establishing causal laws, while the humanities were concerned with the understanding of unique human phenomena. The question was whether the latter had any kind of scientific status, given that it concerned subjects with some capacity for self-determination, rather than law-bound natural objects. In his main contribution to the debate, Adorno states, cognition, Erkenntnis, which also has the sense of insight and recognition, is, and by no means by accident, exaggeration. For just as little as any single thing is true, but by dint of its mediation always has its own other, the whole is in turn just as little true. Adorno, as we have discussed, adopts the Hegelian idea that the truth about things emerges from the analysis of their relationships to other things in a totality. He, at the same time, adheres to the anti-Hegelian idea that rather than this totality itself being the true, it is a context of delusion. Investigation of social phenomena, therefore, has to move beyond, hence, as we discussed, exaggeration, immediate data, such as interviews with people involved in a social issue, to what objectively influences the interview responses that is not apparent in the responses themselves. Hence also the difficulty of such investigation, because the effects of the social context result from systemic factors which are not transparent to those within the system. The untruth of the whole presumably also distorts the responses of those within the whole who seek to understand it. Adorno is therefore careful not to claim that his approach can know what undistorted relations would be, which would require an extra mundane perspective. At the same time, there is no doubt about what massively distorted relations are. Auschwitz makes this much clear. And the paucity of means within society to resist what can lead again to such catastrophe is the basis of how he sees modern society. Only by seeking out large-scale tendencies that are not immediately apparent in the data can the signs of impending danger be made accessible. Whatever may be questionable in Adorno's approach, the warnings it contains cannot be conjured away, as recent history is showing. Adorno makes the source of the dispute, and what he means by positivism, clearer, when he states that positivism regards sociology as one science among others, and since Comte, regards the tested methods of the older sciences, especially the natural sciences, as transferable to sociology. The key elements of the debate have to do with how the notion of objectivity is conceived, and with the relationship between facts and values. In sociology, the concern with values is particularly associated with Max Weber's insistence on value freedom in all the sciences. In his remarks on this issue, Weber is often specifically concerned with teachers not imposing their evaluations on their students, and this points to the essential difficulty that concerns Adorno. The data of social science often consist of people's views of themselves and of the society they inhabit. As such, they involve subjective evaluations, to which people have an obvious right. Whence Weber's concern with the teacher-student relationship, where there is an inherent power imbalance. At the same time, evaluations must be open to questioning. Is the racist entitled to a free pass because they sincerely hold their racist views, based on whatever their values are? How, though, is such questioning to take place? As anyone active on social media knows, just proving that the factual aspects of what someone believes are false generally has little effect, because what people invest in derives from a longer, effectively charged history which shapes their view of the world in ways that are very hard to shift. To take a recent, extreme example, emergency room patients in the USA often don't want to believe COVID-19 is real, even after testing positive for the virus, according to a South Dakota nurse. They don't want to believe that COVID is real. Their last dying words are, "This can't be happening. It's not real." Similar incidents were subsequently reported in the UK. The values and convictions which inform people's views of the world have an objective aspect that is open to critical exploration of their development, and which the people concerned may not be aware of. Adorno talks in this sense of the sheer impossibility of explaining psychologically what does not arise from the inner life of individual people. The COVID patient's convictions are, in these terms, generated by systemic distortions, for example, occasioned by the media, which derive from the failure to sustain a functioning social whole that inspires trust in its members. The basis of Adorno's approach is summed up as follows. The social veil is constituted by the fact that social tendencies assert themselves over the heads of people, that they do not know those tendencies as their own. Moving the veil aside is difficult, because the analysis tells people things which contradict what they themselves see as their relationship to the society they inhabit. Adorno often uses psychoanalysis as a model for this situation, because it argues that many actions are motivated by unconscious factors, which may not enter the mind of the subject performing the action. The key link here is Freud's superego, conscience, the social instance of control in the individual, which is formed through internalization of parental and social norms which precede the individual subject. The externally instituted superego draws its power from repressed drives in the id, which the subject feels as its own, even though the norms it internalizes actually derive from society. The scientific status of psychoanalysis has always been disputed, and Adorno discusses this issue at various points in relation to sociological research, such as that presented in The Authoritarian Personality. He maintains that psychoanalysis, despite being largely ignored by other sciences, and particularly psychiatry, provided hypotheses that were practically viable within the science to explain what was otherwise inexplicable, namely that the overwhelming majority of people puts up with relations of dominance, identifies with them, and is induced by them to adopt irrational attitudes whose opposition to the most simple interests of their self-preservation is completely obvious. the echoes of contemporary politics, in cases such as the UK's leaving the European Union, Brexit, whose worst effects will arguably be felt by many people who voted for it and continue to support it against all the evidence, and poor white people voting for an American president who gives massive tax cuts to billionaires while blocking the introduction of universal health care, suggest the continuing importance of Adorno's approach. Adorno is, then, concerned with the justification of methods in social research, given the demand for it to be scientific. The original aim of psychoanalysis was to produce general psychological laws, but Adorno sees it as its most productive via immersion in the detail of a relatively small number of specific cases, rather than via large-scale surveys that result in inductive hypotheses in the manner of the physical sciences. Talking of the authoritarian personality, which used techniques from empirical sociology, like questionnaires and interviews, to investigate post-war Americans' susceptibility to fascism, Adorno maintains that the book not only encouraged, but also changed the direction of empirical research to some extent, lies in the fact that it produced a concrete relationship between the complex of social psychology oriented towards Freud and empirical methods of research. Not that it presumed to prove or disprove Freud empirically. The concern here, beyond what was specifically at issue in the positivism debate, some of which now appears rather outdated, is scientism, the assumption that the theories and methods of the natural sciences should apply to all disciplines, including the humanities and social sciences. What status does theory with respect to the social sciences have if it does not use the methods of the natural sciences? Adorno maintains that there are object domains in which reality cannot at all be appropriately captured with the norms established by the sciences. The data for the physical sciences are as lacking in qualities as possible, not in themselves already preformed, not in themselves objectively qualified, smallest units or elements. The units or elements of social theories, in contrast, are individual subjects with complex life histories of the kind dealt with in psychoanalysis. In consequence, stripping the qualitative aspects away in order to arrive at quantifiable data derived from survey questionnaires, etc., that can be analysed using quantitative methods, is likely to strip away much of what is essential to understanding a society. An indeterminate amount of factual data can be collected in a society, but much of it may tell one nothing about how that society actually functions. Moreover, choosing which data to analyze necessarily involves evaluation of the kind which value freedom is supposed to exclude. Adorno's objection to what he sees as positivist sociology is that, in at least a very considerable sector of its activity, it is based on opinions, behavior, the self-understanding of individual subjects and of society, rather than on the latter. In such a conception, society is to a large extent the statistically determined average consciousness or unconsciousness of socialized and socially acting subjects, not the medium in which they move. So how is one to gain access to the medium that society is, beyond what is accessed by conventional sociology? Instead of traditional theory, one here needs to engage in critical theory, the term which is associated with the work of the Frankfurt School of Social Research as a whole. Critical theory. The differentiation of kinds of theory can best be understood in terms we have already explored. The key is again relationships between subject and object. Traditional theory, positivism, scientism, etc., treats society, which is potentially the self-determining subject, without further ado as if it were an object, to be determined from outside. Society is only potentially a subject. In its present state, society functions as something objective that stands against individual subjects. One therefore has to see it in dialectical terms. Subjective and objective can only be grasped via changing social relations. Critical theory orients itself, despite all experience of reification, by the idea of society as subject. Given that society is not yet subject in this sense, being instead determined by objective forces over the heads of people, hence its reified thing-like nature, there is a contradiction between two senses of society. Just gathering ever more data about society as it is, in its reified state, can reinforce the status quo. What is the aim of social research if it is not to better society? Popper sees social research in terms of individual social problems that should be addressed by piecemeal social engineering that avoids utopian social engineering, which he associates with the disasters of totalitarian and authoritarian attempts to impose social change. Adorno, who is equally concerned at how social change can become the opposite of what its progenitors may intend, thinks, though, that piecemeal analysis of social problems is not sufficient and must be complemented by the attempt to grasp the wider context and source of the problems. Society only becomes a problem, in Popper's language, to someone who can think of it as different to society as it exists now. Only through what it is not will it reveal itself as what it is. And that is what a sociology would need to do, which does not, as admittedly the majority of its projects do, limit itself to the purposes of public and private administration. The wider context is the totality, which is not immediately apparent in the particular instances. However, the supremacy of the whole, which is admittedly abstract, but in a certain sense also eludes the universal concept, can only be encountered in the experience of the particular, and in the interpretation of this experience of the particular. The totality itself cannot, then, directly be an object of investigation. No experiment could conclusively explain the dependence of every social phenomenon on the totality, because the whole that preforms the concrete phenomena itself never enters particular experimental setups. So how does the totality play a role in social research at all? We just heard that Adorno insists that the totality is encountered in the experience of the particular. It is, therefore, not an affirmative, but rather a critical category. Dialectical criticism seeks to salvage or to help to produce what does not obey the totality, what resists it. This idea will be crucial to Adorno's thinking about art. It is in engaging with a particular manifestation of a contradiction in society that one becomes aware of the need for thinking beyond that manifestation in the direction of the totality that produces the contradiction. Another example from the COVID-19 pandemic can illustrate what Adorno means and why Popper's piecemeal approach may not suffice to grasp the root of social pathologies. In Denmark, which farms millions of mink, it was discovered that they harbored a variant of the virus that might be immune to the vaccines being developed to counter it. This led to a moral dilemma, as a contemporary report makes clear. The cull went ahead, with distressing results. If it turns out to be true that the mink variant would jeopardize our vaccines, and that there's a strong chance that thousands or even millions of people will therefore die if we don't cull the minks, you could make the case that a cull is the lesser of two evils. But we just don't have enough data right now to know whether that's true. We do, however, know one thing with certainty. The fact that we are being forced to choose between two reasonable impulses, wanting to prevent animal suffering and wanting to prevent human suffering, is the result of another decision made. To farm thousands and thousands of animals in close quarters and unsanitary conditions. Rather than there being a morally secure, rational way of deciding between the two courses of action specific to the virus in the mink, relating the dilemma beyond itself to the functioning of mass animal farming for the fashion market shows that society itself is, in Adorno's terms, false. It functions in a way which makes properly rational choices impossible. As long as this kind of production, which embodies what D.E. contended about modern rationalization's instrumental relationship to nature, continues, there is no right way of dealing with what it produces. Looked at in this way, Adorno's at first sight questionable idea that society is itself contradictory starts to make sense and suggests his prescience with respect to the effects of modern exploitation of nature. He contends that if a society is a collective entity for the self-preservation of its members, aspects of society which work against this, like cruel and pointless animal farming for profit, make the notion of society senseless and irrational. Such choices between unacceptable alternatives are fundamental to the totality of contemporary capitalism, which creates situations where there is no good option. The climate crisis also makes this abundantly clear, and Adorno's approach is vindicated by the fact that only by looking beyond piecemeal forms of analysis and seeing things in terms of the totality has the seriousness of the contemporary situation of the world become fully apparent. This is not possible in the kind of terms proposed by Popper. The totality is accessible, then, via the contradictions that become manifest in the attempt to interpret specific phenomena. The interpretation of the facts leads to the totality, without the latter itself being a fact, of the kind traditional theory regards as the basis of justified cognition. It might appear that interpretation would then lead to a regress, where the contradictions involved in a moral choice are a result of the contradictions involved in factory farming, which are a result of the development of particular forms of commodification of nature, and so on. However, in line with his seeing philosophical theories as responses to historical tensions, Adorno points out that the demand for a theory of systemic social pressures beyond the control of the individuals who both undergo them and bring them about does not arise in the same way for pre-modern societies. It is no coincidence that theory of society in an emphatic sense only arose with the Industrial Revolution and with emerging economic liberalism. Adorno repeatedly stresses that in contrast to the success of the natural sciences, despite its advanced age, sociology does not show the least propensity to get closer to the ideal of a real theory of society. In the terms of traditional theory, rejection of the idea that a theory of society should be critical, in the way Adorno demands, is linked to adherence to the fact-value distinction. You can't derive ought from is. The distinction is often seen as a logical one, and is part of what leads to the demand for value freedom, facts being supposedly of a logically different status to values. However, Adorno points out that the distinction, like sociology itself, emerges in specifically modern social circumstances. Its emergence in the modern period is, he contends, part of the dialectic of enlightenment, where increased factual knowledge and the resulting increase in control over nature became divorced from values that would mean they are employed for the good of society. In a phase in which means and ends are torn apart for the sake of the domination of nature, rationality of means progresses along with undiminished or even increasing irrationality of the ends. He also points out, with respect to the distinction as it is often understood, if Popper concedes that the scientistic ideals of objectivity and value freedom are, for their part, values, then that extends into the truth of judgments. Their sense implies the evaluating idea that a true judgment is better than a false one. Truth and value. The idea of truth as a value, which at the time of the debate was not that widely held, has echoes in contemporary mainstream philosophy. Philosopher Hugh Price argues that truth can be seen as a norm in human communication, and what matters is that speakers think that there is such a norm, that they take themselves to be governed by it, not that their view be somehow confirmed by science or metaphysics. Philosopher Hilary Putnam contends that judgments of coherence, simplicity, and so on are presupposed by physical science, yet coherence, simplicity, and the like are values. He therefore concludes, "My pragmatist teachers were right. Knowledge of facts presupposes knowledge of values." But the history of the philosophy of science in the last half century has largely been a history of attempts to evade this issue. There is consequently a need for rethinking the whole dogma that facts are objective and values are subjective, and never the twain shall meet. A pragmatist approach in analytical philosophy here coincides with Adorno's dialectical approach to questions of subject and object, and with his view of sociology as needing to develop theory in a manner which is precluded by the criteria of traditional theory. Adorno derives part of his stance from Hegel's notion of immanent critique, the confrontation of the thing, Sache, with what it, of its own accord, according to its concept, claims to be, which is necessarily evaluative. In the present case, this is the confrontation of what a society presents itself as and what it is, rather than criticism based on a view from nowhere, which would rely on a dogmatic assertion of value from outside the particular social context. The liberal norm of free and fair exchange, for example, is universally developed, but becomes its own opposite in late capitalism. Nobody can justifiably argue against the norm of free and fair exchange, and we cannot do without exchange as the measure of comparability. But exchange can become a means of oppression, as the creation of massive third world debt by first world economic practices shows. Discussion of society, for Adorno, is, then, inherently normative, because the concept of society itself only makes sense in normative terms. A society is not a random aggregate of people, and any society can come into conflict with its concept when it fails to fulfill normative demands inherent in that concept. Fundamental to Adorno's view, as we have discussed, is the fact that we have the means to obviate many forms of human suffering, but that the organization of society so far fails to do this. If hunger is nevertheless present in a society in which hunger would be avoidable now and here, in view of the existing and obviously possible abundance of goods, then this demands the abolition of hunger through intervention in the relations of production. There is no clash of values here, because the idea that one could advocate values that condone other people starving makes no sense if one thinks a society is an organization for the self-preservation and development of its members. The madness here is reproduced on a global scale. Whilst the abundance of goods which could be produced everywhere and at the same time makes the battle for raw materials and markets ever more anachronistic, humankind is divided up into a few armed power blocks. It is hard for us to imagine a state where such division would not pertain. But that is, for Adorno, not a reason to give up criticism of the status quo. The reification has become so dense that every spontaneity, even the mere idea of the true facts of the matter, has necessarily become an extravagant utopia, an aberrant sectarianism. Hyperbolic as this assertion from elements of antisemitism may be, when Adorno and Horkheimer wrote it in DE, they were looking at societies which were annihilating millions of people for reasons which had nothing to do with what those people were and did. In the contemporary world, such an assertion also seems less extreme than it would have done even a few years ago. The questionable notion that we inhabit a post-truth era, better would be an era of what Hannah Arendt called lying as a way of life, adverts to the dangers in complex societies where accurate sources of information compete with massive disinformation of every kind in the new media. Almost anyone can be taken in by such disinformation, given the frequent lack of straightforward ways of identifying it, and the tendency to confirmation bias. Adorno's focus with regard to theories of society is particularly resonant now, in the face of the grotesque wealth inequalities in societies subjected to neoliberal economics, and the concomitant withdrawal from collective concern for the welfare of those societies' less fortunate members. What is perhaps most striking in these developments, and what makes Adorno still relevant to understanding them, is that many of those who suffer their worst consequences support the political forces which are the source of their suffering. The social and the psychological. In The Authoritarian Personality, contemporary echoes abound. It is becoming increasingly plain that people very frequently do not behave in such a way as to further their material interests, even when it is clear to them what these interests are. More important is often a person's larger group identification, as if his point of view were determined more by his need to support this group and to suppress opposite ones than by rational consideration of his own interests. Many aspects of contemporary racism can be seen in such terms, and the reasons why relate to what Adorno says about fascism, namely that in order to be successful as a political movement, it must have a mass basis, since by its very nature it favours the few at the expense of the many. It cannot possibly demonstrate that it will so improve the situation of most people that their real interests will be served. It must, therefore, make its major appeal not to rational self-interest, but to emotional needs, often to the most primitive and irrational wishes and fears. This leads to a further way in which projection plays a role in how the modern world is constituted. Those who suffer from social pressure may frequently tend to transfer this pressure onto others, rather than to join hands with their fellow victims. But why is it that people aim their aggression at what are so often the wrong targets? The difficulty here arises from assessing how the kind of explanation derived from psychoanalysis relates to explanation based on socioeconomic structures. For Adorno, the superego provides a link between the two, but that raises questions in relation to what specific individuals do in real-world circumstances. He tends to see the individual as inherently a product of structural pressures, which means the ego is the object of the superego. But how is it that people are able to resist such pressures at all? Freud thought this involved strengthening the ego against the id, whereas Adorno sees the need to strengthen the ego against the superego. The only true force against the principle of Auschwitz would be autonomy, if I may use the Kantian expression, the force of reflection or self-determination, of not going along with things. However, this still does not fully explain what makes some people actually resist, despite all the social pressures of the context of delusion. Historians tend to say that they cannot find a common psychological, social, or political denominator for those who resisted the Nazis in Germany. Adorno's reflections on freedom and the additional factor, the motivational impulse to act that eludes straightforward normative explanation we considered in Chapter 3, can play an explanatory role here, but it also suggests a further dialectic. If the individual has been co-opted into conformity with distorted social relations which license barbarism, extra-rational impulses that can motivate individual heroic moral action can also be the basis of appalling actions. A threshold between holding a conviction and actually acting in terms of it is in play in both. At the same time, many of the perpetrators were indeed, in certain respects, just a product of those particular objective, historical, and social circumstances. Such people often went on to live respectable lives after the war, when social conditions radically changed. Adorno's insistence on the primacy of the totality helps here. In the objective circumstances of a peaceful, increasingly prosperous post-war Germany, the impetus to transfer social pressure is reduced, though it does not, of course, disappear. At the same time, Adorno's focus on the primacy of the objective arguably does not always adequately explain how, despite all the objective factors that constitute the subject, some subjects still can manage to act in terms of the autonomy he sees as necessary for the avoidance of a repetition of Auschwitz. One of Adorno's most insightful accounts of how social pressure functions is, perhaps surprisingly, to be found in his research on the popularity of an astrology column in a Los Angeles newspaper. This exemplifies his conviction that attention to the experience of the particular can be the key to grasping social phenomena. His assumptions about the nature of modern social relations are summed up in this analysis of how contexts of delusion function. Thus, people even of supposedly normal mind are prepared to accept systems of delusions for the simple reason that it is too difficult indeed to distinguish such systems from the equally inexorable and equally opaque one under which they actually have to live out their lives. This is pretty well reflected by astrology. Such delusion is echoed in the contemporary world by the widespread adherence to conspiracy theories as explanations of what is going wrong. Even though the information that would allow people to understand the real economic and political causes of social and political ills is in certain respects more readily available than ever before. The COVID pandemic once again provides plenty of examples, notably the theories that the pandemic is not real or is massively exaggerated and is part of a plan of those in power to gain more control over the population. Such theories clearly have their roots in people's sense that what is happening above their heads, and their accompanying aggressive claims to superior insight in advancing such theories are based on a deep sense of insecurity. What somebody has as an opinion becomes, as their possession, a component of their person, and what invalidates the opinion is registered by the unconscious and pre-conscious as if they themselves were being damaged. So they defend it even more stubbornly. The reasons Adorno has again become a focus of attention in a world threatened by fascism and climate change are very apparent in the following. It seems that in eras of decline of social systems, with the insecurity and anxiety widespread in such eras, paranoid tendencies in people are evinced and often channelized by institutions wishing to distract such tendencies from their objective reasons. Paranoia is, in one sense, the result of another dialectic of enlightenment. Irrationality is not necessarily a force operating outside the range of rationality. it may result from the processes of rational self-preservation run amok. People rightly sense that things are working against them, but oppose this in politically deluded ways, which often involve projection. In the face of the Trump administration's irrevocable tearing apart of hundreds of immigrant families, in the name of the idea that immigrants are stealing American jobs, many of which had been outsourced to countries with very low labor costs by U.S. corporations, the following has particular resonance. So-called national renewal movements, in an era in which nationalism is obsolete, are particularly susceptible to sadistic practices. Such nationalism is as evil as it is, because in the era of international communication and of supranational blocs, it cannot really believe in itself and has to exaggerate itself to a boundless extent in order to persuade itself and others that it still really has any substance. Adorno suggests another dimension of the distorting effects of such lack of substance when discussing projection on the part of the Nazi anti-Semite. It is as if the anti-Semite could not sleep quietly until he has transformed the whole world into the very same paranoid system by which he is beset. In consequence, the idea of eternal Jewish guilt can be understood as a projection of the prejudiced person's own repressed guilt feelings. And this means that the disproportion between the guilt and the punishment induces him rather to pursue his hatred beyond any limits, and thus to prove to himself and to others that he must be right. This illustrates the tendency of subjectivity to function in terms of domination that we encountered in earlier chapters, and the question is how this kind of narcissistic perversion of self-assertion can be countered. In the face of the crushing evidence of the way social delusion has functioned in 20th century politics and continues to function in the 21st century, it would be naive to expect Adorno to offer generalized answers as to how delusions can be overcome. How can one affect the psychological makeup of individuals who have, like the Nazi anti-Semite, been influenced by objective, systemic pressures, without first changing the systems that lead to those pressures? Adorno sees the basic dialectic here as follows. Society is a total process in which people are enveloped, steered, and formed by objectivity, yet on the other hand, have effects on it. Psychology can as little be merged into sociology as the individual can be into its biological species and its natural history. The same characterological traits may, for example, be pernicious in one social context and beneficial in another. And the preponderance of objective factors of various kinds will affect which is the case. In Education After Auschwitz, Adorno sees the problem in anthropological terms. The necessity of self-preservation means coldness is a basic feature of the constitution of human beings, so that the capacity for identification with other people is, when it comes to the crunch, subordinated to self-interest. He argues that society has, for millennia, been based on the pursuit of self-interest. Clearly, from the very beginning of human existence, survival with minimal technological means of self-defense entails such self-interest, which is a result of objective pressure. At the same time, however, there have to be some means of accounting for the development of cooperation, non-repressive sociality, altruism, etc. Adorno does not in any way dispute their existence, but it is hard to reconcile it with an anthropological account based mainly on self-preservation. Adorno touches on this in a discussion of Kant on practical reason. But that reason which makes itself independent and directs itself towards truth is, so to speak, a dialectical product, so to speak, the child of that self-preserving, in the normal sense, practical reason. Why that non-instrumental product of instrumental reason emerges at all, remains unclear. It can be argued that this is actually more of an empirical question for historical anthropology than a philosophical issue concerning basic features of the constitution of human beings. Not all forms of non-repressive sociality are explicable in terms of self-interest, accounting for what can prevent the war of all against all lies at the heart of political philosophy. If reason is exclusively instrumental, what Weber terms Zweckrational, rational in terms of ends to be achieved by whatever are the most effective means, certain dimensions of human life become hard to explain, and the idea of political progress can seem doomed. Adorno's pupil, Jürgen Habermas, sees the problem in Adorno's position as deriving from a too restrictive conception of rationality. For Habermas, rationality is not always explicable in terms of instrumental self-preservation, because it entails communication. It is implausible to see all communication in terms of the exercise of power over the other, because we can, for example, acknowledge that the other is right and we are wrong, by appreciating what Habermas terms the forceless force of the better argument. As Hugh Price suggests, communication only makes sense at all on the basis of adherence to shared norms. Habermas's exploration of such norms in what he terms communicative action opens up dimensions of social analysis that are sometimes missing in Adorno, for example, with respect to the law, or to what can make everyday social life function relatively successfully. The fact is that Adorno does not, in the main, focus on issues concerning language and philosophy in the kind of terms suggested by Habermas. His approach to how alternatives to instrumental reason can be conceived is developed mainly in relation to the understanding of the arts.